Welcome to Coffee House Shots, Spectator's daily podcast. Is Twitter eating politics? Yesterday, Boris Johnson visited a hospital where he was challenged by the parent of a girl who was being treated there. The challenge was broadcast, it went on social media, and Laura Kunzberg, the BBC's political editor, disclosed that he was a member of the Labour Party. All hell then broke loose as she was accused of somehow politicising her reporting by repeating this tweet. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and by James Kirkup, who's written about this for Coffee House. So, James, remind us, what exactly is this kerfuffle? What's this terrible misdeed that Laura Kunzberg has alleged to have done?
Well, a couple of things, I suppose. First of all, on the minutiae of it, I think what she did was to use Twitter to report words that the gentleman concerned had himself published. And this is a really important point. When you put something on Twitter, you are publishing it. You're not just talking to your mates. You are publishing it. You're putting it into the public domain. So a participant in a story that Laura Kunzberg was covering published words, published his own account of those events. Now, the absolute basic job of journalism is to report the words and actions of the people in the stories that you're covering.
But was it relevant in this case, James? Was it relevant that he was a Labour Party activist? Well, as Isabel wrote in the Evening Blend email last night, whether it doesn't matter if he was the chairman of a Labour Party. In this instance, he was a father concerned about his daughter who thought the health service. So in drawing attention to his political affiliation, does that not undermine
it's just stating a fact. It is a fact. It's a fact he himself states on his publicly available Twitter profile.
Isabel, Laura Kunzberg wasn't the only journalist to make this point. Three or four of them did, yet everybody went for her. Why do you think that was?
Well, because the other accounts that pointed out that Omar Salem was a Labour activist were either male journalists or official accounts from Channel 4 News, for instance. And there is something about a woman in politics pointing things out that might be inconvenient that can just enrage people. And there were MPs. Wes Streeting, actually, Labour MP, the local MP for this father, also pointed to this guy's profile, praising him. Now, I think if I had a child and they were in hospital, I would be about 100 times angrier than this man, that the children's ward that his daughter was on had been understaffed, and this was something that the hospital acknowledged in a statement, that there was a shortage on the ward that night. And, you know, we'd all go absolutely crazy if that happened. But I think it would be relevant if I were then the person going crazy that I was a journalist and that I had a certain perspective on the NHS. I'd expect that to be reported as context, you know, or if I were a Labour activist or a Tory activist. I think it not just informs the perspective that the person who is complaining is coming from, but it also perhaps explains why, for instance, someone is able to express themselves as articulately as this chap was. He used to work for Emily Thornberry. He understands how to pitch a political message, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, because that actually means that he's got the criticism over in a more effective way, perhaps, than someone who, you know, had never seen a prime minister before, found politicians quite scary. Often when you see people meeting prime ministers, they go all sort of goggle-eyed and forget how to talk, whereas this guy had the confidence to make a point which a lot of doctors at Whipps Cross Hospital seem to have agreed with. But it is worth just adding that as context, which I think is the sort of thing that a responsible journalist should do. And I have to say that I think all sides have behaved extremely badly in this. You know, you've had Brexiteer journalists suggesting that he was mic'd up and therefore that this was a political stunt. And that seems to be solely on the basis of the fact that he was wearing a belt, something that I think, you know, men who aren't Labour activists are also capable of doing. And you've also obviously got those on the left suggesting that Laura Kunzberg is undermining his central point just by pointing out that he's a Labour activist. I don't think that's the case. People on the left would have been utterly furious had a Conservative activist confronted Jeremy Corbyn about their experience of anti-Semitism and no one had pointed out that this person was a member of the Conservative Party. You can't have it both ways. If there's information that you consider inconvenient for the other side, it still has to be brought to light on your side too. And in this, I really don't think that being a Labour activist is more relevant than the criticism that he levelled at Boris Johnson, or indeed the thing that made the attack go viral, which was Boris Johnson's bizarre response, which was to claim there weren't any press here while standing a couple of feet away from a BBC camera.
But James, there is another reason why Laura Kunzberg is different from the other journalists who pointed this out. She works for the BBC. Her platform is several times bigger than all of theirs put together. The BBC is under a charter obligation to be impartial. The others aren't. I'm not saying she wasn't being impartial here, but I am saying that BBC journalists are by definition operating under different standards because they're taxpayer financed and people are licensed paid for whatever you want to call it, and that people do believe that what the BBC says and does is fairer game for criticism than what private journalists do. So fundamentally, though, isn't it right that journalists, especially journalists with as much power, let's face it, as the BBC's got, are subjected to scrutiny in social media?
Well, I'll try. I mean, on the fundamental point about scrutiny of journalism, yes, absolutely. But before I get to that, can I just decompose your point a little bit there about the BBC by use of a comparison? At the same time that Laura Kunzberg was tweeting the words of the gentleman concerned, so was Krishnan Gurumurthy of Channel 4 News, also effectively funded by, funded using public money, under the same duty of objectivity via Ofcom.
Ofcom regulated, that's the chest,
Krishnan did exactly the same thing, as he should. He reported the facts, barely a whisper. I mean, there is no firestorm of abuse heading his way. Nobody is suggesting he is guilty of some malign attempt to destroy this poor man and his child.
So, right, and the question there is whether this is because of his organisation or the gender. Yeah, but do you remember in the Scottish referendum?
I do.
Do you remember the abuse Nick Robertson got?
Yeah.
He had placards denouncing him. I agree.
No, I agree. Yeah, BBC journalists get more abuse than non-BBC journalists, and female BBC journalists get more abuse than male BBC journalists. I mean, there's two things going on here at the same time. There is a general sort of punch bag. Let's use the BBC as a punch bag. And as you like to point out in these podcasts, I'm always the person who comes on and defends the cosy establishment. But there are a lot of really good BBC journalists who get a disproportionate amount of criticism for their work, who are basically doing a pretty bloody good job. And somehow, because people feel like, well, we pay for it through our license fee, they have some call on the BBC to essentially do the things that I want them to do. So there's a sort of regular baiting session of the Andrew Marr show for, my God, the Andrew Marr show has had someone on I disagree with. That's terrible. It shouldn't happen.
And they email, they tweet to Rob Burley.
Who feeds the trolls every day. Rob Burley, who is a man of saintly patience, the editor of BBC Live Political Programming, who spends far too much time, and is good for him, explaining calmly and patiently to people on Twitter that, yes, sometimes there are going to be people on television whose views you disagree with. That is life. That is journalism.
Right. But Isabel, is there a sense to which on Twitter there's a sort of game being played? The game is this: that you will get pretty weird people who will not use their names, real names. They'll take somebody else's name, a fake name. And they will, it's almost like Plato's mask of anonymity, that if your name and reputation isn't going before you, then you are then more inclined to do and say more malign things because it won't hurt you. So you will get this crowd of people calling themselves Nasty Weasel, or I think with some other convention where the mad ones self-identify with some initials after their name or something like that. But there's things that people on Twitter do that, in other words, it is a sort of sordid game. So how much attention should we be playing to what is effectively an anonymised sewer, quite often, of abuse?
Well, the problem is it's not anonymised anymore. There were lots of MPs and journalists from both sides of this debate piling in on Laura Kunzberg and on Omar Salem as well. Both of them were being attacked by people on either side. And I think often when we talk about Twitter being a sewer, we do think of those anonymous weasel accounts, as you described them, Fraser. But I think that the tone of Twitter has changed so much over the past few months that it's now considered normal for people with blue ticks, with, jobs at newspapers, who've got their entire employment history in their bio, to be incredibly unpleasant and to also just assume, to have a bad faith assumption about everyone else around them, that everyone else is doing something for malign reasons. And the statement that the BBC put out last night was to say, you know, to assume any malicious motive from Laura Koonsberg is absurd. But that's how Twitter works on an hourly basis. No one says or does anything that is actually with either a good intention or just them trying to do their job. It's because they want to dox an activist, or they want to embarrass the Tories, or, you know, the sort of suggestion that this guy was somehow a Labour plant, as the Labour attack operation is now making people dress up as fathers of sick babies to go into hospital. Everything is absurd, but it's not just the anonymous accounts anymore. We all know who we see first when we log into Twitter. It's certain journalists who are picking endless sort of 56 reply long fights with each other. And this is great for Twitter because it drives traffic, and anger is good for Twitter's business model. But I don't think it's particularly good, not just for our own sanity, but our public debate and for those who do genuinely want to raise concerns. What is wrong with a dad raising concerns about a hospital with the Prime Minister? I don't think we want to make it so hard for those people to do that you only get the really weird people going up to the Prime Minister and having conversations with them, because that won't be good for our public discourse either.
And James, why do you think this matters? I mean, and none of us have spoken to Laura Koonsberg about this, but if I were to guess, I would imagine, first of all, she's pretty hardened to this, receiving abuse like this on an almost daily basis, and during campaigns a lot worse. This is somebody who we know has had to hire security guards to keep away some of the threats she's received from supporters of a certain political faction. So she will have a pretty thick skin right now. So won't she think that the haters are going to hate? This is an inevitable part of public life, and what the job of a journalist is to shake it off.
I get the argument, and this is part of the reason why I wrote about this, why I thought it was worth talking about instead of just saying it's just Twitter, ignore it. And this is not a comment about Laura Koonsberg. It is a comment more generally about women in public life, because I think even if you are tough, if you have that thick skin, if you accept this stuff and shrug it off. Yeah, well, first of all, why should you have to do that? Why should you have to accept abuse as a fact of your working life?
Because Twitter is an asylum, and Twitter is where you go to abuse. You try doing a Twitter search in my name, plus any expletive you want, and you will find no end of very imaginative abuse.
I know, and I'm sorry I sent that. I was angry one night. You know how it is. But, I mean, I agree. But we should, just because something is bad doesn't mean we just accept it as a fact and shrug it off and move on. I mean,
clean up Twitter? I mean, what? Why even bother railing against Twitter?
Because sometimes journalism, even if you can't change the world, you can point out the bad things about it. I mean, that's what we do, don't we?
And aren't you inviting, therefore, the invitation to come onto the asylum? You switch it on. It says, here's the news you've missed. What's the news? Yeah. David Lammy said something mad. Owen Jones has said something mad. Katie Hopkins has said something mad. Inviting you to, I'm going to get involved and I'm going to denounce them.
By and large, I don't, if anybody's stupid enough to follow me on Twitter, they'd realize I don't really say very much on there. But first of all, I don't think we should accept as just an ordinary fact of life that if you particularly are a woman in public life, then abuse is just the norm and get used to it, love. I think that's not okay, and we should say so. But also, I do not think, this is not a comment about Laura Koonsberg, it is a comment based on conversations I've had with a number of friends. I will say I have friends who are politicians, female politicians, and journalists who have been subject to this stuff a lot, and I don't think it is possible to completely ignore it. I think it does weigh on morale. I think it causes people to doubt themselves, it causes them to worry, and I think there are, as I wrote, there's more of this than we can necessarily see in public. There are the effects of a culture where it is regarded as a fact of life that women in the public eye will be abused and shouted at. That's part of a continuum that reaches through to the need for a number of female MPs to have panic buttons at home, to have additional security, to be genuinely worried about their physical safety for doing their job and talking about things. And if we are living in a country where people doubt and question themselves before they say what they think, for fear of this stuff happening to them, we're not properly free. And that, again, is something that we should point out and call out, to use a horrible modern phrase.
Isabel, you've written a best-selling book about the human side of politicians and how this affects them. It's called Why We Get the Wrong Politicians. Now, in your research for that book, did you come across examples of MPs being affected by this kind of abuse? Because you might argue, of course, if you're an MP, you're going to get people shouting at you. That should be part of the job. So you shouldn't really complain if you get abuse. I remember Ruth Davidson, when she went down to the cabinet, she told them to grow a pair. That was her phrase. In other words, get used to the dog's abuse that's going to be thrown at you, because this is what politics is like. But the politicians that you've spoken to, do you get the feeling that this is having, that the digital form of this is having a more pernicious effect than they like to make on?
Yes, I think it's having a real effect on their personal mental health, but also on the way that they conduct themselves. The decisions that they take are often, I think, clouded by what 12 angry people have repeatedly said to them on Twitter. I also notice, and I wrote this in the book, that you often see MPs on Twitter at about 11:30 at night, replying to people called, you know, Truth Defender 56 with a picture of a fox as their avatar. And you sort of think, well, where might those MPs be? Oh, they're in bed, aren't they? They're lying in bed, sitting there, reading all these unpleasant things about them. And I talked to one MP who was a tough cookie, who said, I feel like I'm in an abusive relationship because I'm starting to believe the things that people are saying about me being useless and stupid. So it's not a great place for MPs to end up in. I have to say, you know, to a certain extent, there is a sort of personal mental hygiene thing going on here, where it would be much better if they didn't let a load of angry anonymous trolls into their bed through their phone, and that there are, you know, things that we can all do to stop social media from taking over our lives. I have to say, my sort of defence of Laura Koonsberg last night was quite unusual. I don't tweet very much anymore, apart from when I'm in the House of Commons chamber and something's going on.
Why not?
I just find it a waste of time. You very rarely engage in an interesting debate with people on there anymore. And you end up getting sucked down a rabbit hole with someone who, it's not even that you're never going to agree with each other, because there's nothing wrong with having a debate with somebody who is going to walk away with the same point of view that they brought to it. But it's that they are basically just trying to catch you out and to tell you you're stupid repeatedly. And I'd rather talk to a human face to face. I'd rather see my family, or I'd rather read a book. And I don't mean to sound worthy about this, but I just think life's a bit too short to get into some of these Twitter arguments. So it hasn't even been a conscious decision. I've just found myself less and less attracted to Twitter, because the first thing I see before I even go to my replies feed is people who I like in real life being utterly horrible to each other online. And, you know, if you end up being immersed in a culture like that, it has an effect on your own behaviour as well.
One of the things that I find which is most depressing is people who I like and respect, who I know to be intelligent and thoughtful, behaving like complete idiots because they've been sucked somehow down to the asylum. So they want to denounce this or denounce that and you know that they would never say this sort of thing in real life. And they're developing this sort of avatar, this fake character, which is like the worst of themselves. By the way, it seems to be that academics and journalists can be the worst of this. Quite often you see journalists who say on Twitter things they'd never be able to say in print because a sub-editor or a friend would have stopped them. But what is the answer, James? For example, why is Laura Koonsberg on Twitter? Why would you be on a medium that, if, as Isabel says, right, is there much to be gained by it? And are you not also part of this mad dance?
Yeah, well,
this is my. But by the way, earlier on this summer, I thought about coming off Twitter myself, because I felt that in giving these people a dartboard, I was encouraging these poison darts. When I went on holiday, I had a bot tweet headlines from The Spectator for 2 weeks. That's all it was, a bot. You might not have noticed the difference, but that was it.
Improved your output, I thought.
Yeah, but the point is, but when I came back from holiday, I looked at it. You had homophobic abuse into Matthew Paris's points about Remain, and you had all sorts of poison. And I thought to myself, I might shake my head at this, but I am the one who created this. I am the one who, it takes two to tango, and I was tangoing with this. So maybe if I take Isabel's point of view, and by the way, I do, ought I not to come off this completely? And by the way, I tell you why I didn't, because of a traffic. Yeah. We get 20% of our traffic.
I agree. I do think, I mean, it's sort of the point of the Westminster Village, you know, this is the fascinating navel-gazing conversation that we've gone through phases of Twitter, and that when political Twitter first began 9-10 years ago, it was sort of essentially a lot of friends around Westminster having a jolly conversation with each other, not realizing that the rest of the world was watching. And then I don't know when it was, 2013-14, it turned into the anger machine. But you had to be there because everybody was on Twitter, and if you weren't following Twitter, you didn't know what was going on around Westminster that day. I wonder if we're now into the downswing of that, if actually more people will abandon Twitter, and in 4 or 5 years' time, it will not be necessary to live day-to-day life in the Westminster bubble to look at Twitter all the time. I mean, I go through very similar thought processes. Whenever I go on holiday, I delete it from my phone. I don't look at it. And the longer I go without looking at Twitter, the happier I am.
David Cameron told me he deleted Twitter as well.
Yeah,
doesn't seem to have cheered him up though.
Well, anyway. And obviously we do it exactly for as you say, for the audience. I mean, I can't work out why anybody, you know, say this now. I don't know why anybody follows me on Twitter, because all you get is me tweeting links to pieces I've read, to articles I've written in newspapers and reports I've published at the Social Market Foundation. I don't respond, I don't engage, I don't have conversations, because I don't think there's any point. But I do want a platform, I do want a mechanism to highlight things that I've written and published. And that's why I keep using it.
But I'll tell you my guilty secret, is I am coming to the conclusion that those who engage in it a lot, and I don't know how many tweets I've sent over the last 10 years, but a lot, are part of the problem. But when I tweeted out your piece yesterday, James, I got, and right now it's something like 7,000 clicks from that piece. Now, if you're in my line of work, you need the traffic, but you feel as if you're in a Faustian pact with these guys. And Isabel, do you think that's, I mean, is that, you say you're very critical of it, but still you're on it. Do you think that's because part of it, I know that you obviously journalism is slightly addictive, so I would say I'm probably a little bit addicted to Twitter, though I hate myself for it. I should delete the thing completely, but then again, there's all the traffic. But do you think that is what people do? We sort of turn a blind eye to the abuse which this creates because we need the hits and need the profile.
Yeah, I think most of us need Twitter more than Twitter needs us as well at the moment. I mean, if you have a critical mass of people saying, you know, I don't care about the traffic, I'm just going. But, you know, I have various people whose tweets I get a notification for, and Laura Koonsberg is one of them, because she helps me know what's going on. If I'm out and about, for instance, and I see her tweets come up, at least I've got a sense of what's happening. And I'm sure a lot of other people find that hugely useful. And there are, you know, as well as the traffic, there are some incredibly good and useful things about Twitter, because there are lots of good and useful people on Twitter. Earlier this year, I ran the London Marathon, and I'd set up a series of tweets for each mile explaining why I was doing it. And by the time I got to the finish line, I'd raised about £12,000, and that was mostly off the back of me just tweeting. And so people, you know, you can alert people to important things and to good things, and people, you know, there is good human nature on there, which is why I think to a certain extent, even though I don't particularly want to, you know, get to the end of my life and realise how many hours of it I've wasted on Twitter, I do also think that it's perhaps, as James said earlier, worth us sort of standing up to this angry, abusive culture, because I think it spills into the offline as well. And so if we are encouraging a better discourse on Twitter and trying to use it for good ourselves, then at least we're standing against the culture that is, I'm afraid, becoming prevalent, because we're trying to encourage one another to behave with a little more humanity. And that's important on Twitter and offline. And, you know, we could have this debate about Twitter, also about people's interactions in the street now, the way that MPs are followed around Westminster or even followed home by people. So it's not just the online realm where we're becoming more unpleasant. We're a country that's deeply ill at ease. And I think all of us now have a responsibility to work against that sense of anger.
Isabel and James, thanks very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, on the iTunes Store. Also, you can follow James at James Kirkup, Isabel at Isabel Hardman, and me at Fraser Nelson, all three of us slightly reluctant actors in this great digital drama. Thanks for listening. 'Cause the players-